Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. And then chazak, chazak, v'nit chazek. That's where we concluded the book of Genesis, right? And so this Sabbath, Shemot, we're starting the book of Exodus. We heard the beginning of the book of Exodus from the Torah portion today. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at three different passages in your Bible. And I'll just let you choose which one you want to follow along in, or maybe you want to flip back and forth, but I'm going to be working in Exodus chapter 2, Acts chapter 7, and here, right here, in Hebrews chapter 11. And the material we're going to look at today is fun. It'll be a good time. You'll enjoy it, because I enjoy it. And I enjoy it because this is, to me, is sort of like the fun part of Hebrews 11. Learning Hebrews 11 is just to learn how very, very rabbinic the material is and how much the apostles were employing Midrash as they're reading the Torah and so on and so forth. And this is something that's been obvious all the way through this study in Hebrews chapter 11, that we're drawing on a lot of traditional ideas and sources as our author puts this material together, but it becomes very clear once again today. So here we go. Hebrews chapter 11, commentary on Shemot. He says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that the child was beautiful, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now, as I was telling the children, in the children's story, our Torah portion today narrates the story of the birth of Moses. It's a great story. It has an evil king in it, and a miraculous child. It's got like all the classical elements of a great narrative. And the evil king of Egypt commands the midwives, first of all, he commands the midwives among the children of Israel to kill the baby boys. That as soon as the baby's born and they see it's a boy, they're to kill a baby. But we read, it says in Exodus chapter 2, it says, he says to them, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, kill him. If it's a daughter, she shall live. And then it says, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the male children live. The midwives are being called to exterminate these babies, you know, And it says they feared, not Pharaoh, but they feared God. And what do we know about the fear of God, the fear of the Lord? It's the beginning of wisdom. That's how you get wise, is the fear of the Lord. And what does it mean to be afraid of God? The fear of the Lord, as I often teach you, is to fear God is to believe that he exists, number one. You can't be afraid of something that doesn't exist. So to fear God is to believe that he exists, and that he punishes sin, and that he rewards merit. That's it. That's the essence of it. So it doesn't mean to live in terror. To live in terror of God, as one might live in fear of an abusive husband, or abusive father, or even a ruthless despot like Pharaoh. It means to believe in God, and to believe that he sees everything you do, and to believe that your heart is laid bare before him 24/7, and to trust with absolute confidence that he will punish your sins and reward you for your obedience. That is the fear of the Lord. And this punishment for sin, we know, might be in this world, or it might be in the next world, or it might be in both. And likewise, the reward might be in this world, in this lifetime, or it might be in the afterlife, after our souls are returned to our bodies even, or it might be both. But there will be a settling of accounts and there will be reward. Reward and punishment. It's a concept the authors of what you might call cheap grace have worked very hard to strip from Christian consciousness. But it's very much present in the teachings of our Master, yes, and in the writings of the apostles. So our Master, of course, encourages us when we do our acts of righteousness, he says in the Sermon on the Mount. We're supposed to do our righteous acts not in public, in front of men, to be seen by men, but we're to do them in such a way that we receive our reward from our Father in heaven rather than from the esteem of men. For those who do their righteous deeds to be seen by men, he says, have already received their reward in this world. And the Master teaches us to do our deeds then in secret, so that our Father who sees the secret things, he says, will reward us. And he tells us to show hospitality to his disciples, even to the least of them, so that we will by no means lose our reward. And he tells us that when we are persecuted for his sake, then we should be happy. We should be happy about that. And we should leap and sing for joy. Why? Because, behold, your reward is great in heaven. And the apostles tell us that we should know that from the Lord we will receive an inheritance as a reward for serving the Master, as it says in the book of Hebrews, where we're studying, right at the preface of this very verse 35 of the previous chapter, he says, do not throw away your confidence. It has a great reward. In other words, don't give up. Don't give up your faith, because there's a great reward. He says, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. The Apostle John tells us, watch yourself. Watch yourself so that you don't lose what we have worked for, but that you may win a full reward. I'm bringing you these texts. I know that was a long string of things, but I feel like it's necessary, because there's been such hard work that's put into Christian theology to say there is no reward, there is no punishment, everything's been equalized and leveled off in because of grace, and so on. All right, well, the midwives, they believed in grace too. They believed in God's grace, but they showed the fear of the Lord. They feared God, who's unseen. They feared him more than they feared Pharaoh, who is seen. And for that reason, they disobeyed the king of Egypt. So here's what it says in Exodus. It says, so the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, well, the Hebrew women, they're not like Egyptian women. They're like wild animals. They give birth before the midwife even shows up. So God dealt well with the midwives, which is to say, he rewarded them. And the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. He gave them reward. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. Now, the writer of the book of Hebrews tells us that Moses' parents, you know, Moses' mom and dad, Amram and Yocheved, Amram was his father, Yocheved was his mother, Jochebed. Amram and Yocheved, they acted under the same compulsion as the midwives when they spared Moses' life. It says in Hebrews here, it says, they were not afraid of the king's edict. I find that hard to believe. They weren't afraid of the king's edict. They weren't afraid? Well, look, it doesn't mean that they were not fearful of the consequences. It doesn't mean that they were not fearful of the king's men. The police coming in and discovering the child and putting the whole family to death, perhaps. I'm sure they were afraid of that. If they had no fear of that, they wouldn't have put the baby in the basket. They wouldn't have even hid the child if they weren't afraid of that. So obviously, they were afraid. So why does he say they weren't afraid? They were afraid. The point is, the point the writer of the book of Hebrews is making is they were more afraid of God than Pharaoh. They were more afraid of God than man. The fear of God displayed by Amram and Yocheved, Moses' mom and dad, is the same fear displayed by the midwives, fearing God more than man. It reminds me of, you know what it reminds me of? I can't help it. I mean, when I read these Exodus narratives to think of this, it reminds me of the 10 booms. You know the 10 booms? And the 10 booms are just an example. The 10 booms are an example of thousands, well, hundreds, maybe thousands, of righteous Gentiles in Nazi-occupied territories that hid the Jewish people, helped smuggle Jewish people out from occupied territory or out from Nazi Germany, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who committed himself to making... He helped forge passports to get people out. You know why? Because these few individuals feared God more than they feared the Nazis. It's not that they didn't fear the Nazis. There was a lot to be afraid of there. They feared the Nazis. But they chose to obey God rather than man. And this is what our master teaches us when he says, very clearly to his disciples, do not fear those who kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul. Rather, fear the one who is able to destroy both the soul and body in Gehenna. So like the midwives, Yocheved and Amram, place of fear, their fear of God above their fear of man. It's like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says to his disciples on his deathbed, he says, would that you would fear God as much as you fear man. That would be enough. Because the truth is, he knew that most of us fear man far more than we fear God. Because if we fear God as much as we fear man, we wouldn't sin in secret, as if no one was watching. Yeah? It's obvious, right? And you wouldn't do that in front of so-and-so. Well, that means that but you do it in front of God. Who are you afraid of? So Amram and Yocheved fear God more than they fear man, though God is unseen. That's what it says. That's the whole point. That's the whole point of this chapter. What is faith? Faith is the conviction of things not seen. And so they fear the unseen. And the midwives had the conviction of the unseen. And they acted, therefore, on faith. Which is what we're working on, figuring it out. What is faith? That's what this whole enterprise is about. How do we get it? By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. It's a good thing that wasn't an ugly baby. What does this mean when it says, because they saw the child was beautiful? It sounds like there's something more going on here, and indeed there is something more going on here. The Torah says that when Yocheved saw he was good. So literally it says, saw when he was good. Vatera oto ki tov hu. Ki tov hu, that he was good. Sages offer some explanations reminding us that the name Moshe was the name given to him not by his mom and dad, but that was the name that Pharaoh's daughter, didn't the baby have a name? For 3 months and he's just like baby X or whatever. He must have had a name. And so the sages say, what was his name? Well, what does it say? She saw that he was good. His name was good. Tov. He was called Tov. Tovia. Which is, you know, Tovia is like, it's Tobias, we say. So, yeah. Tov. Rabbi Yehuda says, Tov means he was fit for prophecy. The sages say, when Moses was born, the whole house was filled with light. How do we know? Because it says, she saw that he was good. So the light gave it away. And in another place it says, God saw that the light was good. She saw it's good, Moses. God saw it's good, the light. Making a connection here. Miriam prophesied, my mother is destined to give birth to a son who will save Israel. And when Moses was born, the whole house was flooded with light. Amram rose and kissed Miriam on the head and said, my daughter, your prophecy has been fulfilled. Well, these are some legends. It's interesting that these same legends appear, well, the whole filled with light, baby born, room filled with light. That's a legend that appears in early Christian literature as well regarding the Messiah. Stephen, the first martyr, the deacon, he tells this story, and he brings that part up too about she saw he was good, because it says in Acts 7:20, at the time Moses was born, he was beautiful. And then he says, in God's sight. So he switches it. Who saw that he was? God saw that he was good. It's a baby. They're all beautiful. There's other explanations. But the point is, Yocheved saw that he was Tov, and she couldn't throw him in the Nile. And so she disobeyed Pharaoh, and God rewarded her. Stephen says, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him, brought him up as her own son, and Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in words and deeds. This is interesting, because what Moses says, I am not very mighty in I can't talk. Stephen says he was mighty in words and deeds. Moses grew up then in Pharaoh's court. And at a certain point, he comes to identify himself as a Hebrew. He comes to identify himself with his people. The sages are divided into opinions. Some say this happened when he was 20 years old. When he was 20 years old, he went out to identify with his people. Another opinion says, no, this happened when he was 40 years old. Stephen says it was 40. Because Stephen says, when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart, came into his head, into his mind, I should go visit my brothers, the children of Israel. And so as we're reading here in Hebrews 11, verse 24, it says, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up. So how do you know when you're grown up? When you're 40. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. Fleeting pleasures of sin. I'm just giving you a second to think about what your fleeting pleasures of sin are. Fleeting pleasures of sin.
Maybe you can think in terms of, if you're dieting, you always use the diet analogy. You know, it's like you enjoyed the pizza, but then it was gone, but it's still there.
So choosing to be mistreated with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin, he considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Okay, this we got some problems here. First of all, where in the Torah does it say that Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter? It doesn't. It does not say that. Here's what the Torah says. All it says is, one day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. That's all it says. So the detail about him refusing to be considered a son of Pharaoh's daughter, it's an apostolic tradition. It's a traditional telling of the story that the apostles knew, because we see a similar version on the mouth of Stephen when it says, Stephen says, when he was 40, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, and seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man, and he avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. You see, Stephen points out,
he supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand.
So according to Stephen, this is quite interesting. According to Stephen, Moses intentionally left Pharaoh's household in order to try to bring the redemption and save his people. And this explains another question. What does it mean choosing rather to be mistreated than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin? He considered the reproach of Christ, the reproach of Messiah, greater than the wealth of all the treasures of Egypt. What is the reproach of Christ?
You know, the way people usually read this is like, well, obviously Moses, you know, he knew the gospel. He knew that Jesus was going to come someday and die on the cross for his sins. And so, which, you know, this a little bit of a stretch. The reproach of Christ. In what way did Moses take on the reproach of Christ? What does it mean he considered the reproach of Christ, of Messiah, greater than the treasure of Egypt? I found the answer. It's in the Midrash. It's in the Midrash Rabbah, where we have a very similar tradition. It reads as follows. This is Exodus Rabbah. It says, now, and this is a quote from the Torah. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, he went out to look on his brothers and looked on their hard labors. What is the meaning of looked on their hard labors? It means that he looked upon their burdens and he wept, saying, woe is me for you. Would that I could die for you. And there is no labor more difficult than brickmaking. And he used to shoulder the burdens of each one and help each one. So the writer of our epistle seems to share a common source, a common oral tradition about Moses going out to work on behalf of his people. He's even willing to go so far to die for them if he could save them, to die on their behalf. And this is, I believe, what it means when it says in Hebrews, if you keep that picture of Moses carrying the burdens of his people, here, let me get that for you. And he's carrying the burdens of his people for them. And then keep that in mind and read again verse 25 of Hebrews 11, where it says, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people. Wanted to identify with the people to such a point. The point is that Moses could have retained his position of power. Instead, what did he do? He stripped himself of his royal station. He took the form of a slave. Being found in appearance as a Hebrew, he humbled himself, even to the point of death. He took on the burden and affliction and suffering of his people, willing to die. He prioritized the things of the coming world over the immediate luxuries and comforts and cable television that was available to him in the palace in Egypt. And he took on the reproach of Messiah, and he chose to suffer for his people. That's the reproach of Messiah. Suffering on behalf of others. In Stephen the Martyr's recitation, he has it that Moses killed the Egyptian to try to redeem Israel, remember? He supposed his brethren would understand that he was granting them deliverance. So what is this reproach? The reproach is simply this: to set oneself aside, to suffer on behalf of others. It's the opposite of the human instinct to flee pain and pursue pleasure, isn't it? Moses forsook pleasure and he pursued pain on behalf of Israel. That is the reproach of Messiah. Why did he do that? Because he believed it was more valuable than the riches of Egypt. And Egypt has a lot of riches. I see a lot of disciples today in the Messianic Jewish movement who are not able to bear the stigmatization of Messiah, much less the reproach of Messiah. Not able to stand up under it, to be identified with him. Because of the reproach from the larger Jewish world. Well-earned reproach, by the way, but reproach all the same, and it's never fun. And under the weight of that reproach, some disciples buckle and cast off the master. We've seen it happen many, many times. And God forbid that we will see it again. But there's nothing new under the sun. There's no surprise in this. Some will stand, some will fall. And those who stand will stand because they choose. Because they choose to be mistreated with the master rather than to enjoy the pleasure of men's esteem. They consider the reproach of the Messiah greater than the esteem of men. And they're looking to the reward and seeing him who is invisible. So by faith, they cling to the commandments of God and the testimony of Yeshua. Persevere and endure. And to those who overcome, he says again and again that he will give a reward. To the one who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven. And I will write my own new name, Revelation 3:12, and many other passages similar to that. This is very similar. This whole situation I'm describing is almost identical to the situation that the writer of the book of Hebrews is addressing when he brings us this entire faith chapter. The whole point of this faith chapter is just to say, don't give up. Stand firm. Yes, it's not difficult, but look back to the examples in the past. We are not the first to be part of this story of faith. Others have gone before us. For example, Moses, who we're talking about today. As we read here in verse 27, by faith, Moses left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king. Which, once again, is like, wait a second. Not afraid of the anger of the king. It's like, what does that mean? It's like, all right, I'm going to flee to Midian. But not because I'm afraid that Pharaoh is going to arrest me and kill me. I was going to go to Midian anyway. I was just on my way there. I just happened to be leaving today, now that the murder I committed has been discovered. It's a little hard to believe. In fact, the Torah disagrees. The Torah says in Exodus 2:14, it absolutely contradicts where it says, then Moses was afraid. That's exactly what it says. Then Moses was afraid. Surely the thing is known. But the writer of Hebrews says, by faith he left Egypt not being afraid of the anger of the king. Lest we get the impression that Moses flees for his life. He wasn't afraid. It wasn't fear that motivated him to leave Egypt. It was faith. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king. For he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Again, once again, I mean, you'd have to say, where is this coming from? Where is he getting this idea? But again, the answer is in the Midrash. If we go to the Midrash, we find out that Moses didn't flee right away. Instead, it says, when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses, and he had him arrested. So Moses didn't flee, and then Moses is arrested. So Pharaoh sent for a sword,
that had not its equal. And he struck him. He's going to behead him. He has his executioner, you know, the big Egyptian executioner, giant Hittite guy. And he's got this sword, this giant, gigantic sword. It doesn't have an equal. And so there's Moses with his head on the chopping block, and the sword comes down, whoop. And it says, but the neck of Moses became like an ivory pillar, and he could not harm him. So bang, the sword hits that neck and falls out. He's like, the sword falls from his hands. You know, you don't have to believe that. It's just a story. But the writer of Hebrews believed it. I mean, he at least heard stories like that. So according to the writer of the book of Hebrews, Moses didn't flee. He didn't flee because he was afraid of Pharaoh. He left by faith, not because of fear. Yes, he was afraid of, you know, Pharaoh is going to arrest me, of course, and that sort of thing, and it's been discovered. But the real point is that he feared God more. He went out of Egypt in faith, trusting God, not just fleeing from Pharaoh, but entrusting himself to Hashem. Why? Because it says he endured, which is what we're talking about. Enduring. That's the whole point, right, of the chapter. He endured as seeing him who is invisible. All right. Does not mean that he saw him who is invisible. If he saw him who is invisible, he wouldn't be invisible, would he? No. Instead, it says, as if seeing him who is invisible. If you could see God, it'd be a lot easier to believe in him. It's like, I mean, if every time you went out of your door, you looked up, and it's like, oh, hey, God. It's like, yeah, no, I was going to pray. It would be different, right? That's how it was for Moses. Because it was as if he did see him who was invisible. As if he did. As seeing him who was invisible. That's how he endured. That's why he was not afraid. Okay. What have we learned here? I hope several lessons from the book of Faith and Hope. Several lessons. We've learned that faith places the fear of God above the fear of man. Fear of God is belief in reward and punishment. We've learned that the reward of God outweighs the punishment of man. What's the worst thing that can happen to me from the human hands doesn't compare with what God will reward me with. And vice versa. The best that I can get from human beings doesn't compare with the punishment I'll get from God. So the fear of God above the fear of man. And that, and we've talked about how this has a social level too. That esteem of God is more important than the esteem of man. It's more important how I look in God's eyes than how I look in the eyes of other human beings. And this operates on a private, secret level too, because a secret sin, our willingness to sin as long as we think no one is looking, betrays our lack of fear of God. It's a lack of faith. All right, so this is something we learned. That faith places the fear of God above the fear of man. A second thing we learned here is that faith takes risks on behalf of others, like the midwives, like Amram and Yocheved, even though it was their baby, it was still a risk. Or like the ten booms, right? And we learn that faith chooses the path of self-denial if necessary.
if necessary, faith chooses suffering. Can you imagine choosing suffering? Who wants to suffer? It's like, oh, I'll do that. Nobody does that. Faith does that. Faith chooses to be mistreated. Like, yes, I will take the mistreatment. Rather than enjoy the fleeting, quickly passing pleasure of sin. This might mean choosing social stigmatization. It might mean choosing a path of exile. It might mean choosing to be in a place of loneliness, unpopularity. Faith looks not to the immediate circumstance. It's got its eyes on the prize, eyes on the eternal reward. And that is why it is possible to weigh the reproach of Messiah higher than the treasures of Egypt. Faith looks to the reward. And finally, what have we learned here? We've learned that faith endures because faith beholds him who is invisible.